The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway this morning. A headline in the Jerusalem Post this morning reports, U.S. approves Rafah operation in exchange for no Israeli counterstrikes on Iran. Then I look at the Telegraph in London. It says Israel delaying Iran revenge attack until after Passover. I'm joined now by Dr. Michael Oren, ambassador, formerly ambassador to the United States from Israel. He's in his bunker in his great studio with the great lighting, which is the best studio, I think, in Israel. Good morning, Dr. Oren. I do not understand the wilderness of mirrors that we're in. I have a column at Fox that says it's now or never time for Israel. What is going on in your view?
And I'm going to give you the four words I hate giving most, which is damned if I know. Really, damned if I know. You don't hear that often from me, right? It is very confusing. And I could see various deals that could be cut. You know, the United States could say to Netanyahu, okay, do not strike back at Iran less now, at least not in like some very provocative, inflammable way, and we'll make it up to you. And how could the United States make it up to us? It could make it up to us in terms of Gazan currency. It can make it up to us in terms of strategic capabilities. Now, I'm going to reveal something on this show. I've talked about it maybe publicly before, but never on your show. I several times tried to reach an arrangement with the Obama administration about acquiring strategic bombers. Israel does not have strategic bombers. We've got this wonderful Air Force full of wonderful, terrific little airplanes called F-15s, F-16s, and F-35s, which are, again, terrific, terrific aircraft, but they have short ranges and limited payloads. Especially the F-35 has a very limited payload because everything outside the airplane, you know, takes away the stealth qualities of the aircraft. We don't have a strategic bomber that can bomb something from 50,000 feet carrying a 50,000-pound bomb. And I tried to get the administration back then to even lease us one of those B-52s, the B-1s, B-2s, and got nowhere. I was working on it with the Trump people until that administration ended. But that's something that Israel needs. And I think if that deal would go through, where the United States would provide us with several of those very large aircraft, that would send an unequivocal message to Iran that Israel now has a very keen ability to eliminate their nuclear program. And okay, maybe that would be worth it. Maybe worth it some American support for an operation in Rafah and to stop, you know, calling into question our commitment to humanitarian law enough already. There are various deals that can be reached. At the end of the day, it was interesting. There was almost like a one line in the New York Times that you could have passed it by, and that is in the discussion Saturday night. It was not Netanyahu, but it was Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot from the opposition parties in the National Unity Government, the so-called moderates, who are pressing for an immediate and massive military counterstrike. And with the complaint that every day that goes by, the pressure on Israel to not react would mount. And I can't say they're wrong.
I think they're right.
My gut feeling is that Israel should have responded and should have responded quite dramatically, smartly, but dramatically, smartly. And Iran is a target-rich environment. Lots of oil facilities on the Persian Gulf. Need I go further? And that Israel should move into Rafah. I don't understand why we're waiting.
Dr. Oren, I don't either. I think it's now or never time, and that Israel will forfeit deterrence. Even if you get a bunch of old B-2s, or even they send you some B-52s and say, work on them, that's nothing compared to what the mullahs will think about Israel. They will conclude. It really comes down to what does your enemy think. and your enemy will think you won't strike back, and the next time they hit will be worse. That's what I think. Does anyone discuss this in Israel openly about what Iranians think?
We go back. It's also going back to playing by the Iranian rules. And I've said this on this program several times. We have been playing by Iran's rules for 15 plus years. And it's not just Israel, it's the United States. And what are the rules? Iran shoots at us through its proxies, not through Iran. Shoots at us through its proxies. We fire back at the proxies. The proxies hide behind a civilian population. We end up killing some of those civilians, you know, however hard we try not to. And we get branded war criminals. And that happens every single round. It's happened in this round with Hamas. And then Iran gets away scot-free, never pays any price. It can kill three American servicemen, service people in Jordan. It can block shipping through the Mandeb Straits to the Houthi rebels. Iran never pays a price. And if the United States and the world, together with Israel, do not exact a price from Iran, Iran is just going to keep on doing it. And we're going to keep on losing.
Now, Prime Minister Netanyahu has an undeserved reputation as a hawk. And I say undeserved because he is among the most cautious world leaders who've been on the world stage for a long time. You know him well. What is more of a threat to his coalition, not acting or acting?
Now it's not acting. Right now it's not acting, though apparently the Israeli public, according to a poll I saw yesterday, the majority of Israeli public is against a very dramatic response to Iran. But within his coalition, there are those who are pushing in all different directions. You know, the Ben-Gvirs and the Smotriches want to respond to the Irani attack and to enter Rafah immediately. They want to reestablish Israeli settlements in the Gaza Strip. And that's going to be an issue coming up. Mark my words.
You know, Dr. Warren, correct me if I'm wrong. Ben-Gvir and Smotrich are to the Israeli politics what Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massey are, except they're not anti-Semitic. Thomas Massey is anti-Semitic.
I would say Green and Massey.
Yeah, and so I don't pay attention to them. I do pay attention to Derry, who is the finance minister, and he is an observer in the war cabinet, along with Eisenkot and the Ron Dermer. And so he seems to be on the cautious side. Have I read the reports correctly?
That is typical Derry, though. Derry supported the Oslo Accords. He's been around for a long time. And he is a very moderate individual. That's why one of the reasons Bibi wants him in there. It's one of the reasons that Bibi fought to get him hard to get into the government, even though the Israeli Supreme Court voided his nomination on the fact that he has spent time in prison several times for corruption. So, but he is a voice for moderation, and he's a very intelligent individual. I can't speak for his financial dealings, Yeah, he's that voice. He's the voice of restraint.
Because I never heard this until I went to work for Nixon in the late 70s. I haven't asked you about it before because I've forgotten it for a long time. Sophocles wrote, "You don't know how good the day has been until the sun is set." So we don't really know what Netanyahu's reputation is going to be until the last act of the Netanyahu career is over. If this is the last act of the Netanyahu career, what's his political legacy if he goes out letting Iran strike Israel with 350 projectiles or 330 projectiles?
Let me speculate out of the box what that last chapter could look like. It could look a grand bargain with the United States in which a NATO-like structure is made in the Middle East. It includes Saudi-Israeli peace. It includes understandings about the Palestinian issue and how to proceed toward it in a way that doesn't threaten Israel and Israel's neighbors, because a Palestinian state would threaten not just us, but virtually the entire Middle East. It is the way that Israel, that the United States provides those armaments and those capabilities we need to defend ourselves against Iran. And there's a big White House ceremony. Maybe there's a ceremony in Oslo as well. And that's the concluding chapter.
That's not going to happen, right?
Actually, I just threw it out there for your perusal, for your enjoyment.
I'm thinking he risks going down as the boy who cried wolf, because he has mowed the grass until 10-7. Now he's launched the Gaza war, which had to be launched in response to 10-7. And now he's holding back, and I do not understand this. And I know I talked with Admiral Mark Montgomery, who you probably know, retired Rear Admiral of the United States Navy. You've got allegedly, Israel has submarine-launched ballistic missiles. They've got ballistic missiles. They've got Admiral Montgomery thought your F-35s had payload capacity that maybe you could damage the Iranian sites. But it depends on weather and cloud cover and the phases of the moon and all that kind of stuff. Are people talking about this in the Israeli media?
Not much. I mean, I think it's well understood in this country that Netanyahu is extremely conflict averse. Now, there are some harsher terms they used about him, but conflict averse. And it's always ironic that the world thinks he's such a militant, so aggressive. He's just the opposite. And sometimes that works in Israel's favor, and sometimes it's questionable whether it does.
Now, if you're an Iranian, you're used to doing this. You're a strategic thinker. If you're an Iranian advisor to the Ayatollah Khamenei, and Israel does nothing, what do you tell them that tells us, the Iranians in this case, about Israel?
It says that, you know, we're an easy target. The question is how you hit the target next. Do you hit the target with, you know, 350 more projectiles? Some of those projectiles were extremely large, and 500 kilograms of explosive, enough to take down an entire neighborhood, never mind a building. And or you keep on doing what they did. Yesterday, Hezbollah struck a community center in an Arab village in the north in which Israeli soldiers just happened to be billeted. That, what does that tell you? It means they knew those Israeli soldiers were billeted in that community center. It's a remote village. So they have intelligence on us. And they wounded 18 of these soldiers, some of them seriously. It's letting us know here's how we're going to proceed. And we're really going back to what we're doing before, is using our proxies to gnaw away at you, to render the entire part of the northern part of Israel uninhabitable. People can't live in Upper Galilee. 60,000-80,000 people out of their homes. The army bogged down. And the IDF up north feels that they're kind of like they're sitting ducks. And that's playing by Iran's rules. We're back.
Now, you know, that detail, the media keeps leaking out details about the strike on the community center. Originally, it was 4 hurt, 1 seriously. Now it's 19 soldiers. Is that the Israeli sensor machine at work? Is that what's going on there?
I don't know. I know sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Usually you don't inform. We'll say the soldiers are wounded without releasing their names until the family has been notified. That's certainly the case of fatalities. I don't know, but I think it what they're not saying in any of the press reports you're reading is, how did this drone know where to find these soldiers? And that, to me, is a very scary scenario to contemplate, that they actually know where in a remote Arab village our soldiers are billeted. And that, think about that, Hugh. That's the first thing that struck me when I read that article.
We'll come back after the break. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm going to talk with Dr. Oren during the break and then after the break, because I rarely get this opportunity to ask him at length what's going on inside of Israel. And this is the Wilderness of Mirrors time as Passover begins on Monday. We'll talk with him about that as well. Don't go anywhere. I'm Hugh Hewitt.
Portions of the Hugh Hewitt Show are brought to you in part by AmFed Coin and Bullion. Go to AmericanFederal.com for more info.
I'm back with Dr. Michael Oren. He is in Israel. He's in his media bunker where he spends most of his life talking to the American media and everybody else about what's going on in Israel. Dr. Oren, yesterday, Dan Senor interviewed Professor Galloway, Professor Galloway describes himself as a far-left progressive atheist. He's also Jewish, and he's had quite the awakening since 10/7 about what is the reality of Israel. Is that commonplace throughout the world, and is it especially commonplace in Israel that people have just completely abandoned any idea of a two-state solution and embraced the reality of the region in which they live?
For the Israeli left, the first punch came in October, a different October, October 2000, with the outbreak of the Second Intifada, and that followed immediately on the heels of an offer of a two-state solution by then Prime Minister Ehud Barak to Yasser Arafat, head of the PLO, mediated by Bill Clinton at Camp David. Israel was prepared to give the PLO about 96.5% of the West Bank, all of Gaza, and half of Jerusalem, to redivide Jerusalem, believe it or not. And Arafat walked away from it, simply up and walked away. And a month later, boom, the Second Intifada breaks out. And 1,000 Israelis are killed. And what the left had always predicated its belief that the conflict was about the outcome of the Six-Day War, you know, the West Bank and Gaza. But since the Palestinians had rejected a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, it wasn't about that. The war was not about the outcome of 67, it was about the outcome of 1948. And that was a huge blow to the left, and very prominent leftists began to move the other way. So that was the first blow. The second, the two punch of the 1-2 punch came on October 7th, where Israeli peace activists, many of them living along the border, people who had flown kites over Gaza saying, we want to make peace with you, people who waited at the border to take Gazans to Israeli hospitals, people who invited Gazans into their homes because they were working in their communities, found that these same people they were inviting in for coffee were actually taking notes about how many people were in each house, who had a dog, how many kids, who had a gun, who didn't have a gun. So the terrorists knew everything, what was in every house. And that's a huge, huge blow to the Israeli left. It's still out there. It's going to be, I always say it's like the end of fatal attraction. You know, just when you think they're gone, the hand's going to come up and get you. They're incorrigible. But it's a huge blow. And I don't think my own family is a good barometer, Hugh. They're kind of center left. And when I mention the possibility of a two-state solution, they look at me and they say, you're crazy. You're nuts. No way.
Well, let's go north for a second to Lebanon. If Israel is poised to invade Lebanon, mm-hmm. have they possibly held back from responding against Iran because they can't deal with the Hezbollah threat? In other words, deterrence failed there, too, and they're recognizing the reality of it. Sort of like France in 1941, they thought they were ready and they'd get rolled. Is Israel afraid they'd lose the war in the north?
I don't know if they're afraid to lose the war in the north. I think they're afraid that the price might be a little prohibitive because you're talking about 150 to 170,000 rockets. We've seen how accurate these rockets are. We've seen that their drones can pick off a community center. These rockets can target our vital utilities, airfields, oil refineries, Dimona. And they have 100,000 terrorists under arms. That's more than three times the size of the force in Hamas. And these people are very experienced in killing because they've been massacring Syrians for the last half decade.
Hold a second, doctor. We got to rejoin the network. Yeah. We're going to rejoin the network with Dr. Oren right after this. Stay tuned, America. I'm back now with Dr. Michael Oren. He's in the suburbs of Tel Aviv in the media bunker that Dr. Oren has made famous around the world, in his Harry Hopkins-like role of doing public diplomacy for the rest of the world. All right, Dr. Oren, we're heading up to Passover. May you have a blessed one. I hope your family is together with that.
Thank you.
People want predictions, and I know they always want predictions. Mine aren't worth anything because I don't know anything. You know everybody. What do you think is going to happen here?
I'm optimistic by nature, and I think that Israel can reach a new understanding with our neighbors. I think that peace between Israel and Saudi Arabia is possible if the Israeli government can throw a little bit of flexibility. But the key to it all is in the White House. And what do I mean? You know, starting in January 2009, the first week in office, Barack Obama turned to Iran and said, "Let's reconcile." And that has been the policy of the Democratic Party pretty much uninterruptedly since then, for 15 years. If now there's somebody in the White House has the guts to stand up and say, listen, this failed, this didn't work, and we have to move from reconciliation to confrontation, then the United States will find that it will regain its great power status in the Middle East. It'll have many countries that'll rally to its side, and we will stick together, and we will overcome Hamas, we'll overcome Hezbollah, we'll overcome Iran with that type of front. And that's my vision for the post-Passover season. Again, the Jewish people rescued from bondage, and this time bondage to horrible terrorist groups, to terrorism, and achieving freedom, true freedom, freedom from fear in our ancient homeland.
But let's close this way, Dr. Oren. If Israel does nothing, what do those hundreds of thousands of young men and women who went into Gaza and the survivors of the 10/7 massacre and the despondent, depressed, and I gather a lot of them have taken their own lives, who have survived this horror, What do they think of this government if it does nothing after Saturday night and it doesn't go into Rafah and it doesn't invade Hezbollah? Do they give up on elected officials?
Again, no. It's very different. Remember, I think I've said before that in the year before October 7th, during the great struggles over the judicial reform, the army was politicized. Units of the military, particularly commando units, the pilots said they wouldn't report for reserve duty. So the army was politicized. That genie did get out of the bottle. Now that it's out of the bottle, the army has a say. And it's not necessarily the pilots and the commandos. It's the grunts, it's the infantry, it's the tank and armored units and artillery. People who come from development neighborhoods. By the way, half of their officers wear a kippah. They're religious. And they're going to say just what you said. What did we fight for? What did we die for? Why do we watch our friends bleed? The statistics are coming out now about the numbers of Israeli soldiers who are wounded and grievously wounded, thousands. And they're going to say to the government, no, you cannot cut a deal right now. You can't run. We have to see this through or else all of our sacrifices have been for naught.
Last question. I have seen Naftali Bennett everywhere. It seems to me you told me that everyone gets to leave Israeli politics once, like Bennett did, and then they get to come back. Is that what is going on here, the preparation for the return of a younger, more robust version of a Likud leader?
Yep, absolutely.
Will it work?
Well, he's got some challenges. The right wing of Israel feel betrayed by him. He ran as a right winger and ended up acting as sort of a center-left leader. So he's going to have to sort of get back into at least some of those good graces. It won't be entirely possible. But you know, the question is, who does he take votes from? And right now, the way he's poised, I think he would take votes from Benny Gantz. He'd take votes from Yair Lapid, but he wouldn't take votes from Netanyahu or from the Likud. He has to get to a point where he can take votes from both sides.
All right. We will leave it there. Have a wonderful and blessed Passover, Dr. Oren. I hope the next time we talk, we're talking about how Israel responded so devastatingly that Iran dare not ever attack it directly again. And who knows what next week is going to bring. We'll find out. Thank you, Dr. Oren. I begin this hour with United States Senator Marsha Blackburn, one of our regular guests, and we are glad she is a friend of the program. Senator from Tennessee. Good morning, Senator. Welcome back.
I am delighted to join you.
Senator, I don't know if Judiciary Committee has jurisdiction over this, and you're a member of that. Catherine Maher at NPR has to be removed. She is an out-of-her-mind left-wing activist, and that's my taxpayer dollars and the taxpayer dollars of Tennesseans going to a propaganda machine which won't even allow liberal people to write freely at their paper, at their platform.
And NPR and public broadcast is something that I have worked on since I was in the House, and accountability for these entities, because they have drifted further and further to the left. And moving them to a platform so that they become a nonprofit. The taxpayer ought not to be funding this activity. And so we are working on this. We're working on reviving some legislation. But, you know, I hear many times, Hugh, and here's a great example. The NPR station in Nashville is over near the Titans football practice stadium. And I have heard so many times from people that live outside of Nashville, they're coming in to watch a practice game. They drive by this station, this public radio station that is like a Taj Mahal of radio stations. And they think about in their hometown, the local radio station is generally a cinder block building with a tower out front, and you've got two or three people that are running the station, and many times they will comment about this. And same thing for public TV. We have so many different options.
Yep,
it is,
Senator,
important for us to reconsider this.
I worked for PBS for 10 years. I like PBS. I was both national show and their local affiliate, KCET in LA, for a decade. I liked them. But I beg for money for them on air. They have lots of money. They don't need taxpayer dollars when they have a crazy person running the place.
And it is important that we realize if they want to stay free of advertising, then utilize their foundations and their nonprofit status. But the taxpayer does not need to be funding this. Right now, when we talk about infrastructure, we're talking about the need to expand roads and bridges and the need to be cautious of our national debt and what we are putting our money into. This week, we are looking at what is going to happen with funding for that southern border and how we're going to deal with funding for our ally Israel, what is going to happen around Ukraine, the desperate need for transparency and accountability for the $113 billion we have already spent there.
Well, let's go to that, Senator, because this weekend your old colleagues in the House are going to vote on four bills, and then it's going to come over to you as a package: Israel, Taiwan, Ukraine, and the American industrial base. I am a strong yes on all of those, a strong yes. I understand the problems with Ukraine, but we can't do it now with Iran attacking Russia on the move, China preparing to invade Taiwan. A strong yes. What do you think of those four votes your House colleagues have to take?
We want to see what they actually send to us. Of course, when it comes to the southern border, the House sent us H.R. 2 in May of last year, and Chuck Schumer and Dick Durbin have chosen to never take it up. Not one hearing, not one discussion. So let's see what happens there. Israel, as you are aware, Hugh, I was on the floor Monday night pushing to fund Israel, go ahead and get that $17.6 billion they need out the door. They have been very prescriptive in what they need that money for. And $4 billion for the Iron Dome, money for mortar resistance, which that's money going into David Sling and Arrow, and money to reinforce security with our embassy that is there. So all of these are components that they can give you the line items. Now, when it comes to Ukraine, there are three buckets. The military bucket, no one's really fussing or arguing over that. The two other buckets, which are humanitarian aid and government support. We need to know where that money is and where it is going. When you look at the amount of money that we are putting into Ukraine, then it is important to know where those dollars are. And having military aid move forward, I think that could just about go on a unanimous vote. But it is these other buckets.
And I agree.
It's important to
note,
we do not want Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, the Ayatollah, or Kim Jong-un to get a victory. No one wants the axis of evil to get a victory, but we have to be good stewards of the taxpayer dollar.
Well, I think that's going to happen. I think that it's going to be, if not 100%, very close to 100% military purchases only. Senator, I got to close with a personal question for you. I think I've talked the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt into moving to Tennessee out of the Beltway, because I hate the Beltway so much. But Knoxville's got Schroeder in it, so that's out of the question. And Nashville's crowded. Who has a good airport? Because I move around a lot. I got to do speeches, and I got to go to a market visit. Who's got the best airport that you can get in and out of quickly if I got to go to Maine and D.C. and California?
Well, of course, you've got Memphis, Jackson, Nashville, Chattanooga, Knoxville, Tri-Cities, they all have great airports with good, friendly people, so come on down.
Well, but someone's going to have the right-sized airport, like Portland, Maine. The International Jet Port at Portland, Maine is my favorite airport in America because I got 9 gates and 4 TSA people. What's the smallest, best airport? Please don't tell me Knoxville.
Let's see. I think Chattanooga has maybe 8 gates. I'm not sure about that. I think Knoxville maybe has about 12 gates. and trying to pull this off the top of my
head. Don't worry. It's just that Knoxville's got Schroeder in it. And when you put an Indiana in the middle of Tennessee, it's trouble. Senator, I appreciate your taking the time with me. Last question. I want to go back to serious stuff. Do you expect Israel to respond directly to Iran? Should they? And what will you say on the floor of the Senate if they do, if they strike directly at Iran, at its refineries, its nuclear programs, its IRGC headquarters?
What we know is this. Israel needs to do what Israel should do to protect themselves. And they do not need a lot of Monday morning quarterbacks trying to tell them what and how to do.
Well said. Senator, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Have a great weekend in Tennessee. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. Congressman Mike Garcia is a veteran of the United States Navy, where he flew F-18s. Welcome back, Congressman Garcia. I told the audience earlier this morning that long ago and far away, you flew briefly with my son-in-law when you were an older F-18 pilot. He was a younger F-18 pilot. He's gone over to the driving of the ships part now, but he's still on active duty. And so I'd like to know from an aviator's perspective what you thought. What did he think? What did every F-18 and F-35 pilot and F-22 pilot in the world think about what happened on Saturday night?
What we saw, obviously, over the weekend with the Iranian drones and the attack on Israel was another clear demonstration that Israel is surrounded by people who are literally trying to kill them, and they have a right to defend themselves. And they have a very sophisticated integrated air defense system, and that was demonstrated. These volleys from Iran were not that sophisticated, not that complex, but the volume of them was pretty deep. You're looking at close to 300 projectiles of either ballistic missiles or larger, smaller UAVs and faster missiles. So it was testing the capacity and the ability of the commanders on the ground to target and to triage incoming missiles as well. So Israel has a right to defend itself. They have a right to retaliate. It's not clear if they will right now based on everything I'm hearing. But they have an IOU here in the pocket, and Iran needs to be held accountable for this for everything that's going on in the Middle East right now.
Now, Congressman Garcia, I do not know if F-22s left our base in Qatar. I don't know if F-18s from the Eisenhower were involved or F-35s were involved. But what was the degree of difficulty in terms of the integration of France, England, Israel, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Jordan? Have we ever done anything like that since World War II?
Well, there's been war gaming exercises, large force exercises, joint ops in practice of it. One of the challenges was this was in the evening, but what was mitigating the challenge was that a lot of these UAVs especially were traveling at less than 200 miles an hour and had 6 to 8 hours of travel time before they got there. So what also is very apparent is that Israel has Arrow 2, Arrow 3 for longer range, surface-to-air missiles. They have David Sling for medium range, and everyone knows about Iron Dome, which is the short point defense system. But they also have F-15s, and they also have F-35s, which are the equivalent of American capabilities. And so they have sophisticated Air Force assets, sophisticated ground assets. And I think the Arab nations like Jordan and others supporting the defense of Israel is a very actually encouraging sign that the region understands how dangerous Iran is behaving right now and how big of a threat this is to the region, not just to Israel. So it could have been a lot more complex and complicated, but they handled the problem well, and I'm understanding effectively damn near 100% in terms of percentage of threats taken down successfully.
Now, Congressman Garcia, I really appreciate your being with me today, because tomorrow or Saturday you're going to have to vote on 4 bills that will then be packaged depending on the results. Aid for Israel, yeah. Aid for Taiwan, aid for Ukraine, and aid for our industrial base. And I had a retired 2-star in the Marines tell me yesterday, we're running low on stuff. We got to build some new munitions. How will you be voting on those 4 bills? I hope it's yes on all of them.
Yeah, it's yes on all of them. I'm doing a deep dive on the Ukraine package because I have been adamant that, you know, Ukraine, Zelensky is not asking for blankets. He's not asking for Band-Aids and beans. They need bullets. We need to provide them the warheads to put on the Russian foreheads, and that's all we should be doing. If we're going to do humanitarian aid or direct government support, then it should be something that has some sort of, you know, lend-leased terms and conditions hooked to it. But we've got to provide them the right munitions package, and this is what I've been doing the deep dive on. I don't want to just keep giving them World War One, World War Two mortar rounds or surplus garage, you know, sale type weapons that we have been giving over the last year and a half. They need the weapons to win the war against the former Soviet army here, and so I support it. I think it needs to be a knockout punch. We've got to compel Putin to come to the table. And to do that, you've got to make sure that they're armed. But yes, our own military has an industrial base problem right now that can't be overstated. And it's not just the contractor's fault. The Pentagon needs to actually put people on contract faster. We need to invest in our shipbuilding. To put it in perspective, China builds 2 ships per month when we effectively net 1 new ship every year. And we actually decommission more while we do that. So we have a huge capacity problem, not a capability problem, but we have a huge capacity problem relative to China.
Congressman, I'm glad you're here because I want to ask you a question that the civilian in me, I'm just ignorant about this stuff, but I wonder, why haven't we sold the AC-130 or given the AC-130 gunship, what is known as Spooky, so memorable from the early days of the Afghanistan war, to the Ukrainians? It's World War One, but Spooky would make a difference. Are we afraid it would get shot down?
Yeah, it's a slower moving, and it does need to be at a higher altitude for the gun to be effective. It's a great air-to-ground gun. The problem is the Russians have S-300, S-400 surface-to-air missiles, which would take them down. It's also the problem that the F-16s that the Ukrainians have been asking for will have as well. In my opinion, we should provide them A-10s. A-10s can stay below 500 feet. They're a little bit quicker than the C-130 or the AC-130, and nothing puts the fear of God in the enemy like the 30-millimeter cannon on the front end of an A-10 overhead. And sometimes you don't even need to shoot at the bad guys. If they just hear the gunfire, they will retreat. We saw that in Iraq back in 2003.
Yeah, I have heard from many, many Marines that the A-10 is their best friend. And I don't know that the Ukrainians have the ability to fly them or not. That's a technical question. So back to the politics of the moment. Marjorie Taylor Greene, I don't talk about her much. She has her own district, her own world, but she didn't vote against McCarthy, so I leave her alone. She's wrong to try and out the speaker. And Tom Massie, I just think, is anti-Semitic. And I think he's actually a very bad guy. But other than those two, is anyone else going to vote to oust the speaker?
I haven't heard anyone talk about that legitimately besides the two of them. You know, being the speaker right now is literally like dousing yourself in gasoline and handing 220 matches to your, you know, teammates. And you're expecting those folks not to hit light those matches, but we've proven that we are crazy enough to do that. So I think right now Massie and Marjorie are the only two talking about it. I don't think that is going to become a reality, and I think you'll have a Republican army behind Mike Johnson to prevent that from happening. We've got to maintain control of this majority and legislate. And set ourselves up for
and do you think some form of all four bills will be passed by the House to send to the Senate?
I am confident of that. I think there's going to be some drama and some dentistry, and I don't know if it's going to be, you know, in the next 48 hours. But I think we will know here shortly, probably today, the timeline. But yes, in my opinion, especially the Clean Israel bill, that should be a no-brainer. And if we just do that a la carte right now and get whatever...
I pray you're right. Congressman, it's malpractice for me not to give your campaign website. What is your campaign website? Because California 27th, we got to hold it in the fall. What's your campaign website?
Yeah, absolutely. We're like swing district, electmikegarcia.com. We need all the help we can get. We're in the throes of it in L.A. media market, so appreciate all
elect
the
What? Tell me again slowly.
electmikegarcia.com.
electmikegarcia.com. Thank you, Congressman. Good luck this weekend. Folks, so many people I know are disheartened that our country seems to have forgotten the importance of citizenship. And they wonder how a strong sense of citizenship might be revived. That's why my friends at Hillsdale College have produced a free online course on the topic, American Citizenship and Its Decline. Taught by historian Victor Davis Hanson, the course traces the history of citizenship and explains how it is undermined in America today by open borders, by identity politics, by the administrative state, and by globalization. Americans taking the course will gain a deeper insight about the connection between citizenship and freedom, an insight they can share with family members, friends, and neighbors. Hillsdale's free online courses are an important component of Hillsdale's mission to reach and teach increasing millions of people on behalf of liberty and the American way of life. So sign up today for Hillsdale's free online course, American Citizenship and Its Decline, by visiting hughforhillsdale.com. That's HUGHFORHillsdale.com. Hughforhillsdale.com. Start your free course today at hughforhillsdale.com. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway, joined by Noah Rothman, senior writer at National Review. Noah, I just talked to Dr. Michael Oren for a half hour from Jerusalem, and I must say, he looked and appeared and sounded weary, as I imagine every Israeli is, of 6 months of war and horror. What do you think the United States is telling them, based upon your reading of all the sources on the Biden White House?
I think they're telling them not to go. I think that's what we're hearing from just about every Western ally of Israel, is that, hey, you didn't take this one on the chin. You dodged a bullet. In fact, we helped you dodge it. And now it's incumbent on you to show restraint, to demonstrate that you have the capacity to dictate the tempo of events, and therefore you should hold that in reserve. I think that's madness. I think that would demonstrate that Israel would have been deterred by this strike, not the other way around. And that deterrence against Israel deterrence against Iran would not have been restored. And Israel can therefore expect the precedent to have been set that it can, Iran can execute direct attacks on Israeli territory at times and places of its choosing. And maybe the next time Western allies won't be in the air to support them. Maybe next time one of those ballistic missiles that penetrated Israeli airspace will be armed with a weapon of mass destruction. And I don't think Israel can accept that, but Israel's Western allies appear to believe they can, or at least they think that's in their interests to telegraph to Israel right now.
Well, according to the Jerusalem Post this morning, PM shelved pre-approved plans for immediate Iran reprisal after a Biden call. And according to the Jerusalem Post, the headline was, Biden has said okay to Rafah, but don't go after Iran. I mean, it's a wilderness of mirrors, Noah. I don't know what to believe. Yeah. I do know that I think Iran will judge that an enormous win if nothing happens to them. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I would imagine that's true. And the idea here that we can put Rafah on the table after months of leaning very heavily on Israel in public and private to, A, not go into Rafah, and if they did go into Rafah, to not relocate the population, and if they didn't relocate the population, to make sure they protect the population somehow, they erected this elaborate framework in which Israel would have been restrained from seeking to fulfill its mission, which is the destruction and neutralization of Hamas as a political and military force on the Gaza Strip. They've been saying, you can't actually do that. So now, to put that on the table, to sweeten the notion that they can just simply absorb this Iranian attack, is craven in the extreme. It's profoundly it disregards not just Israel's national security interests, our own national security interests. We have a permanent interest in seeing the Islamic Republic contained and deterred. It is undeterred. Wait, and it's not Israel. Israel's its only target. The United States is its target. Three Americans died, and scores more were wounded as a result of attacks directed by Tehran against Israel and its allies, including us. It is a profound dereliction of responsibility from this president.
Craven in the extreme is Noah's phrase, but I'm stealing it. Speaking of the president, Noah, he was in Pittsburgh yesterday. I want you to hear this. Cut number two.
Back when D-Day occurred, And on Sunday, the next day, my mother's four brothers all went down to the recruiting station and joined the military. Every one of them volunteered. And my uncle, they called him Ambrose Brosey, they called him Bosey. My uncle Bosey was a hell of an athlete, they tell me when he was a kid. And he became an Army Air Corps before the Air Force came along. He flew those single-engine planes as reconnaissance over war zones. And he got shot down in New Guinea. And they never found the body because there used to be a lot of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea. And then my son volunteered to go to Iraq for a year, and he came back with stage 4 glioblastoma. And they gave, like many of you, risked your lives, and you know people who gave their lives to the country. They're heroes. But one of the things that I, as I was doing that today, I was reminded of what my opponent said in Paris not too long ago. They asked him to go visit American grave sites. He said no, he wouldn't do it, because they were all suckers and losers.
Oh.
I'm not making that up. Staff was with him, acknowledge it today. Suckers and losers. That man doesn't deserve to have been the commander-in-chief for my son.
I think there's so many things wrong with this, but I want your reaction to it, Noah.
Well, I mean, let's leave the substance aside first. We'll get back to it. But it's hardly inspiring. Just physical conduct from the president of the United States, his inability to muster anything resembling vigor when he's talking about some of the most active measures that you as a nation can take and you as a commander of a chief can order is uninspiring. Last second, the substance of the comments are not rooted in something. They're rooted in something resembling truth because his family did fight in World War II, but as far as we understand it, his family was not eaten by cannibals. I mean, I can't believe I actually have to say that sentence out loud. It's an absolutely bizarre, elaborate fiction that he seems to have erected in his head and may appear to believe, but that itself is an even more disturbing set of circumstances, and the president just does this. We've become accustomed to him running at the mouth and just erecting these elaborate cathedrals of events that have happened in his past that bear no resemblance to anything that can be proven or borne out by the government records that keep records of this sort of thing. These are demonstrable fictions. And we just kind of let it go, brush it over. Because if we were to actually dwell on what it means that the president lives in this alternate reality, it would be terrifying. It would compel us to do something about it. Indeed, to trigger the constitutional mechanisms to do something about it. And we can't really think about it.
Uncle Bosey did exist. He did crash in Indonesia. Yeah. He was lost. He was not piloting. He was hitching a ride. And he was a brave warrior, as were the president's family. But the conflation of John Kelly and the comments about Senator McCain, all of it is conflation. All of it is an old man stumbling around in the windmills of his mind. What you got is exactly what I got. He's infirm and getting worse. And we are voting for Kamala Harris for president if we vote for Kamala Harris. Maybe he'll simply lay down the burden of the office sometime in January, February next year. Maybe he won't make it to the election. I don't know. But you don't reverse this kind of decline, Noah. I don't know if you've seen it in your own family. I've seen it in mine.
No, yeah, I think everybody has, which is why this is such a problem for him, because you can't talk your way out of it. It is informed by all of our personal experience with the mental deterioration that you experience naturally. If you're fortunate enough to reach the age that Joe Biden has reached, it's a great accomplishment on his part, and his family should have had the wherewithal and the foresight to be able to remove him gracefully from the public stage. They did not do so. And now we have to bear witness to it. But one of the reasons, I think, why the age issue is such a problem for Joe Biden is because you can't talk your way out of it. You're literally trying to compel the American people to forget their own lived experiences, to forget their own challenges that they went through with their family members, and to subordinate that to an ideological goal, which is to preserve Joe Biden, the aura around Joe Biden, the fiction that he is a competent and capable commander-in-chief. And that's just not going to fly. It's too big of an ask.
No, I listened with great interest to your hosting Andrew McCarthy on the McCarthy Report yesterday. I am wondering if you think, I think Trump's going to be convicted. And I thought Andy was very, very good on the specifics of New York law, but I still think it's a done deal. What do you think?
I mean, it's hard for me to speculate. This is so outside my realm of expertise. Nevertheless, those who have expertise, like Andy and others, believe that the jury will be able to convict on at least one of these 34 felony accounts that have been spun out from this misdemeanor account. And the stakes are incredibly high if he does not get convicted. So one of the things that we've been seeing in the polling around this for a long time is that it doesn't make sense to partisans, particularly on the left or right, who follow this very closely. But voters who have not followed this closely, which is, by the way, a plurality of voters, believe two things. One, that the DOJ and his prosecutors in Manhattan and Georgia are out to get him, that this is all politically motivated, that the timing is too conspicuous, they're too aggressive, too dogged, this is all political. And also, he probably did it. Whatever he's accused of, he probably did it. These thoughts exist simultaneously in the same heads, and they're mutually exclusive to partisans. And I believe they are mutually exclusive, because over the course of this trial, we're going to find that Donald Trump will have been, if he's convicted, he'll be convicted on these charges, and they'll say, okay, he really did. If they can't find the second charge, they will probably conclude that all the charges he's facing from the DOJ in Georgia and elsewhere are all bunk.
I would recommend the McCarthy Report to everyone, because it is all bunk. But that doesn't mean a New York jury from Manhattan primarily isn't going to convict him, because I think they are going to convict him because it's Donald John Trump. Noah Rothman, thank you. Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
You're tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is. But we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that, because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is and it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's
864-644-1900.
Welcome back, America. I'm turning now from Israel's dilemma and the former president's trial to the three bills which will be voted on tomorrow, or excuse me, on Saturday. The three bills aiding Ukraine, Taiwan, and Israel, as well as a fourth bill which will provide money to the defense establishment. My first next hour, Senator Blackburn, Congressman Garcia, Josh Krasauer right now, Senator Jim Talent, retired from the United States Senate. Senator Talent, good morning. Welcome. I want all of this to pass. I don't think it's a close call. What do you think is going to happen? What should happen?
Well, let me take the second question first, you. I think you're right. It all ought to pass because all of those measures enhance American security. You know, the irony of all this is that the people who have been resisting Ukraine aid want America first, and I completely agree with that. I was probably the least cosmopolitan person in the Congress when I was serving there. In this context, putting America first means degrading the power of our adversaries, which is what all of this is about, really. Okay, so Israel is fighting our adversaries in the Middle East. Vladimir Putin has shown himself to be an adversary of our interests around the world, and not just in Eastern Europe, of course. We see him as an ally of Iran in the Middle East and Bashar Assad. And, of course, he's declared his unlimited friendship with China and Xi Jinping, which, by the way, in the context of the traditional Russian-Chinese enmity, can only be because he's trying to hurt the United States. Do you know that I'm going to digress here for a second. The Chinese recently put out a map of northeastern Asia in which they labeled the Russian cities with Chinese names.
I did not.
That shows what their objective. Yes, that shows what their objectives are regarding Russia. And obviously, enhancing the security of Taiwan is in our interest. And Tom Cotton was right. The most important part of that package may be strengthening the defense industrial base. So will it pass? I don't know. I think eventually, in some form or another, it will pass. But I think Johnson's come up with a good idea right now. This may be the best chance to get it done quickly.
Now, Senator, I was asked by John Tobin of the Jewish News Service this week to do a podcast with him, wherein he asked me, why are you so in on this? And I said, because I don't want my grandchildren to live in a second-rate power with a third-rate economy. And I really do believe the West is on the line in Israel and Ukraine in a way that, I don't know how many Americans get it. Do you? And I cited Reagan and the Reagan doctor. He said, how long will we keep up aid to Ukraine? I said, well, that we didn't ask that in Korea. We didn't ask that for 20 years in Afghanistan. And Ronald Reagan never asked that about the Mujahideen. Do you agree with me?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we keep it up until we enforce and finalize the defeat that Russia to this point has suffered, because strategically what Putin wanted to do was not only gain Ukraine, but he wanted to split NATO. He wanted to show everybody he was a conquering hero and give him momentum around the world. And he wanted to enhance his security position in Eastern Europe. Well, of course, what's happened is Finland and Sweden are now in NATO. NATO responded with greater unity than I'm certain he expected it to happen. So we need to enforce this defeat on Russia. And the way to do that is to bring this conflict to an end in a way that does not do further damage to Ukrainian security.
No, I'm not a maximalist.
In order to do that, we have to keep the Ukrainians fighting.
Yeah, I don't know what the end game is. I have no idea.
They're probably never going to get it.
You're right. They're never going to get it all back.
They're not. But we want to go to the negotiating table against the context of a battlefield that is moving in the direction of Ukraine. That's the only thing that's going to get Putin to the table. I mean, even if all you want is for this conflict to end, you have to show Putin that we will support Ukraine until he is willing to agree at least to a reasonable deal.
A quick exit question, Senator. I got to ask you this. Israel doesn't respond to Iran directly, how will you assess this exchange and Israel's future?
I think Israel has to respond. Let me answer it this way. If I were Israel, I would be telling the United States, if you don't want us to respond right away, here's what you have to do. You have to refreeze the assets. You have to reimpose the embargo on missile parts, you have to enforce the sanction against oil, and you have to comprehensively attack the Houthis and the Iranian maritime assets that are being used to supply them. That will give us time and space in order to respond at a time of our own choosing and in a way that's more acceptable to you. So I would throw it right back into Biden's lap, and I would tell him, if you don't announce you're doing those things within a short period of time, we're responding.
You know, your old friend Joe Biden doesn't look very good, Senator. Have you seen him?
Yeah, he does not look very good. And, Michael Oren said something yesterday, which is very much worth repeating. The whole problem here is they've tried to structure a security arrangement around a partnership with Iran, and it won't work.
Well said. Senator Jim Talent, thank you. Coming right back.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway, joined now by Josh Kroshauer. He's editor-in-chief of Jewish Insider. You can follow Josh on X at Josh Kroshauer. Josh, what is American Jewry thinking right now, as far as you can see, about what Israel has and has not done since being attacked on Saturday night?
Yeah, look, I think we were actually reported on a meeting that leaders of American Jewish communal institutions had with Secretary of State Tony Blinken. And look, there was a lot of mixed opinion. I think the big, the overwhelming concern was that the message that the administration has given when it comes to Israel and when it comes to deterrence is not been as robust as it otherwise could be. I think rhetorically, they've been generally satisfied. But I think when you talk, you're talking about the, you know, and I think, look, the results, the defense and the alliance in you know, knocking down the missiles from Iran last weekend was a big success story. And I know the White House has been looking to really emphasize that. But the big question is on why are they trying to pressure Israel not to respond and not to create some degree of deterrence from Iran's aggression last weekend?
Josh, I'm very worried, and I'm not Jewish. I'm a believer in the West, and Israel's a free democratic country and a strong ally. I am worried if they don't strike back at Iran, deterrence is gone, and that Iran will proceed to break out with a nuclear weapon because they'll realize Israel will not act. Does anyone echo me within the councils that advise the Biden people, as far as you can tell?
Well, you know this, covering the Biden White House. There is a great sense of caution across the board when it comes to this administration and foreign policy. I mean, remember back to when Russia was about to invade Ukraine, and the guidance that a lot of the leadership in the administration gave to Zelensky was to, you know, get out of the country. Like, let's get you a ride out of the country and instead of fighting back. And it turned out the Russian invasion was, you know, far less imposing than a lot of the intelligence community in the U.S. advertised or thought. So, like, this has been par for the course. There's a sense of caution. It's not just the U.S., by the way, Hugh. It's David Cameron and then the British, intelligence and diplomacy and other Western allies. It's a sense of caution and not wanting to create, a greater conflict, even though Iran has been attacking Israel through its proxies and then this weekend directly. So we're already seeing the conflict in action.
So Josh, my question is, though, among American Jewry, as far as you have reported, do they want Israel to strike back? Forget Biden. Just what do American Jewish leaders, because if they want to, they can make their voices heard much louder than Arab Americans in the Democratic coalition. But they have chosen not to do so. We saw them all. I was there. There were 300,000 people there on like a moment's notice.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think overwhelmingly they want Iran to be deterred. I think you actually in Israel, there's a lot of polling that reflects that they the vast majority of Israelis want a response against Iran. They don't necessarily need it to be in the moment. I think there's a sense, and this was expressed by some of the Israeli military or political leadership. Benny Gantz, I think, made the point that we should strike back at a time and place of our choosing. So it doesn't have to be right away. There has to be a response, but it doesn't have to be right at the moment. So, look, I think you'll see a response from Israel. I have little doubt about that. And Netanyahu has said as much. But I think, you know, there has been a lot of pressure, as you've noted, Hugh, in trying to, you know, limit the scope of the response from Israel.
A last question that's internal to Israeli politics. I've watched Naftali Bennett on American media. I've seen him reemerge on X. I think he's going to reenter whenever the next election is, and it could be 3 years away. And I think he's going to be persuasive. I think Netanyahu's era is coming to a close because this is just unacceptable. What do you think about Bennett?
Yeah, look, there's going to be a long list of potential successors to Bibi when he and I think, depending on when the election is. But I think whether he stands for re-election or whether he steps aside, his approval ratings in Israel are quite low. I don't see him serving another term. Look, I think the big question is going to be who emerges. And I think there's this tension in Israeli society where you have a hawkishness, a desire for deterrence, a desire for a restoration of security, but at the same time, a dislike of Bibi and the current leadership. So I think you'll have the odds of a very conservative, hawkish-minded leadership, but a younger leadership, one that may have really been learned a lot from what happened on October 7th.
Josh Kroshauer, thank you. Follow him at Josh Kroshauer, and it's very difficult for Dwayne to spell. Kroshauer. Josh Kroshauer, editor-in-chief of the Jewish News Service, thank you. Thanks, all of you, for listening. If you have a congressman who's a Republican or a Democrat, call them up and tell them to vote yes, 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 yes on the four bills. The Rules Committee meets at 10 a.m. They'll probably go for a long time, well after my show stops airing. I assume that the rule that they pass will bring all four bills as the speaker. Good on you, Speaker Johnson. Good on you. Leadership is hard sometimes, especially when the peanut gallery's got Tom Massie, who's just dumber than a donut on national security and is anti-Semitic to boot. When you've got dumb people in your caucus, you just have to ignore them and take the tough votes, even when your majority is narrow. Support Israel, support Ukraine, support Taiwan, support us, and vote yes on these four bills. I'll be back tomorrow, America, on the next Hugh Hewitt Show. Thank you, Harley. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Dwayne.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.